Why Republican Kevin Ray believes he should replace Democrat Mike Michaud in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. 10 years ago, Kevin Ray and Mike Michaud squared off in a race to represent the 2nd Congressional District in Maine. This election cycle, they face each other again. Ray argues that Michaud has become part of the problem in Washington, and Ray touts his own ability to work with the other side as one reason that he should replace the incumbent. Ray says he embraces the label of moderate and draws comparisons to his one-time boss, retiring Senator Olympia Snowe. I'm Keith Shortall. Today we'll ask the Eastport native and small business owner why he believes this time around voters in the 2nd District will vote for him over Mike Michaud. Join the conversation. Email talk at mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, post a message on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-399-3566. Kevin Ray, Republican for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. This is Maine Calling.
Broadcast of Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine with offices in Portland and Blue Hill, by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com, and by AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/ME.
And Kevin Ray, welcome to Maine Calling.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How's the campaign going?
It's going well. Going well. Covering a lot of territory, having a good time, and meeting a lot of Maine people. We've been all over the district. In fact, since June, from June until a week ago, I had been somewhere in a parade in Maine every single Saturday. Maine does love its parades.
You must have picked up a lot of candy on the way.
I tried to avoid that.
We often hear about how the 2nd District, I think, is the largest congressional district east of the Mississippi.
That is true.
Talk about a little bit about the challenge of trying to campaign in it. And it's also very rural.
It certainly is, yeah. You know, it stretches from Fryeburg on the New Hampshire border to Eastport in Lubeck on the New Brunswick border, and obviously up to the St. John Valley as well. So it's over 27,000 square miles, and it certainly does pose a challenge. Fortunately, I've had a lot of experience in the 2nd Congressional District. For 11 years, I ran Olympia Snowe's offices in the district in Bangor, Auburn, and Presque Isle. So dating back to those days, I've spent a lot of time on the road getting to know the communities and the issues. So it's an enjoyable process, even though you do log a lot of miles.
It's an interesting story about how you first became connected to Olympia Snowe. I think she was actually campaigning herself. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, well, I was a high school kid. I was 16 years old, and I was very interested in politics. I used to always watch CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite with my dad growing up. And I had seen an article in the Maine Sunday Telegram that State Senator Olympia Snowe might be considering a run for Congress if then-Congressman Bill Cohen decided to run for the U.S. Senate, which he did. So for whatever reason, I was inspired to write a letter to Olympia. Did not know her. She did not know me. But I sent this letter to her and told her that I would, perhaps be interested in volunteering on a campaign, and I'd like to know more about her. Lo and behold, she wrote back to me, 4-page handwritten letter, which I believe my mother still has. And she encouraged me. She said that she was thrilled that I liked politics. She answered my questions and encouraged me. A few months later, my phone rang. One evening, of course, being a teenage kid, my mother said, "It's for you." And I said, "Is it a guy or a girl?" And she said, "It's a girl." So I took it upstairs, thinking it was going to be a girl from my class. Lo and behold, it was not. It was Senator Olympia Snowe. And she told me she was in Washington County, very much would like to meet me. So she came to my house the next day. We sat at my kitchen table and chatted, got to know each other. I took her into Eastport to visit some local people. I can still remember vividly, she was a completely blank slate. Not a single person knew who she was when I took her into downtown Eastport. Some people thought her name was Olivia. One person thought her name was Olympic Snow. And that turned out to be the beginning of a very long relationship and the beginning of a relationship in which Olympia has been a mentor and a great influence in my life.
So would you say that you were a Republican in high school?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was. I remember as for whatever reason that I gravitated to that, even before that. I can remember as young as I was 7 years old in 1968, and I remember staying up into the wee hours of the night watching the returns for Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey. Wow. In fact, I did not go to school the next day.
I remember the walk on the moon, but I don't think I stayed
I remember
up for
that
the returns.
Too.
I want to ask you about something in the news recently. There's been some coverage of the fact that the National Republican Congressional Committee has not spent money on your behalf, and I want to ask you about how that feels, and is it an indicator about how they feel this race is going?
Well, actually, until I saw that article, it's not something I had actually given much thought to. I guess, according to the article, in about half of the so-called young gun races, they have waded into the TV wars. And in approximately the other half, they have not. Apparently, I'm in that half.
Young guns, just to clarify, are sort of up-and-coming.
Yeah, young guns is the designation for those candidates. It doesn't refer to age. 51, I don't think I'd make the cut for young. But it refers to those candidates that the NRCC believes have demonstrated the capacity to win. And so they become the targeted races.
So you're on that list.
Yes, yes. One of, I think there are 30-some around the country that have been given that designation. I am one of them. I don't read any particular importance into it one way or the other. September is still relatively early in as far as the television is concerned. And frankly, I wouldn't have any idea if they intend to do anything in my race because there's a firewall. It would be illegal to even, have those discussions or to be aware of it in advance. And so I really have no idea.
All right.
Yep.
Let's get to some of the issues. I think economy is still number one on the list.
Yes.
I think we asked you this the last time around, but let's revisit it. What can you, as a 2nd District Congressman, do in Washington to improve the U.S. economy and the Maine economy?
Well, certainly with respect to both the national economy and particularly with respect to the Maine economy, I believe the single most important thing is to do all we can to ensure that small business can thrive and be successful. Here in Maine, literally 99% of the businesses in our state are small businesses, and they are the heart and soul of our communities and the lifeblood of our economy. As a member of the Maine Senate, I've worked very hard to ensure that we do everything we can to allow small business to be successful in Maine. Recently, I received the endorsement of the National Federation of Independent Business, which is the nation's largest small business advocacy group. They have more than 3,500 members right here in Maine because I have a 100% record in support of small business issues. My opponent, on the other hand, has a zero, a record that is sort of hard to achieve, frankly. I would include among the issues that are important to small business to be regulatory reform at the state level. LD1 I sponsored is the landmark regulatory reform legislation that we passed here in Maine in a bipartisan fashion, 35-0 in the Senate, 147-3 in the Maine House. But we're seeing at the federal level, frankly, moving in the opposite direction. I was just this morning at the early bird breakfast at the Bangor Chamber of Commerce, as we heard from folks in Maine's paper and pulp industry, obviously a vital industry in Maine's economy. And they were asked by the moderator about regulatory reform. And what we heard from them was that they're actually pretty pleased with the way things are going at the state level in terms of sort of a renewed emphasis on trying to help businesses meet regulations rather than be the hammer, but that they're increasingly concerned at the federal level with the red tape and bureaucracy. In fact, one of the presenters held up his hands to show us how thick, some of their regulatory hoops are in terms of permitting. At the federal level, it's getting worse. We need to make sure that we're removing that burden in a way that makes sense, that will still ensure that we have clean air and clean water. And I've been active, too, in trying to remove harmful chemicals. But we need to do it in a way that does not put American businesses and Maine businesses at a disadvantage.
So, but apart from regulatory reform, are there fiscal moves that you could make, tax reforms that you would suggest to create jobs?
Well, there certainly are. Here at the state level, for example, during the last biennial budget, I offered a measure which was included in the budget for the Maine New Markets Tax Credit, which encourages investment in parts of Maine that have been left behind economically. And we actually had another bill this past session to sort of further its and expand the scope of it.
So isn't that everything away from the coast? Or
yeah. Well, frankly, it is. I mean, certainly the 2nd Congressional District is an example of areas that have been left behind economically. One of the projects that is in the pipeline as a result of this new tax credit that we put in at the state level is the torrefied wood facility, wood pellet facility in Millinocket. And heavens knows that the Katahdin region, Millinocket, has been hit very hard with the closure of the Millinocket mill. The East Millinocket mill is back open, but it's certainly at reduced levels of employment. So the torrefied wood facility up there is an example of the kind of investment that we can encourage through innovative tax policy. And I'm looking forward to see that come to fruition.
How serious is the debt? Is the debt in danger of ruining our future economies? And if so, if it's that serious, I'll let you answer that question. But yeah, what do we do about it?
It is. I think it poses a grievous threat to the future of our country and to the future prosperity and future generations. I'm concerned that the level of the debt is so significant and so staggering that it's difficult for people to even comprehend how critical it is. When you hear $16 trillion, it's almost to the point I think people's eyes glaze over. They can't quite take it all in what that means. But it poses a very serious threat. And I think what it does is it puts this generation of Americans in the position that unless we shift course, we are poised to leave this country worse off than we found it.
So by shifting course, does that mean increasing taxes and cutting spending?
Well, I'll tell you what it means. It means that when the election is over and we have whoever's left standing, a certain number of Democrats, a number of Republicans, and a president who will either be Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, that there is a shared responsibility to move past the digging your heels in philosophy of that each side seems to have and solve problems. Now, frankly, when it comes to tax increases, it's difficult for me to conjure up a great deal of enthusiasm for increasing taxes at a time when our economy is so precarious. Usually when the economy has been this precarious, in the past, we've had tax reductions to try to spur on economic development and job creation and growth. So I remain to be convinced that it would be a wise course to raise taxes. I have not taken the position of signing the pledge that would remove that as an option. I think it's frankly counterproductive for both sides to come to the table having drawn lines in the sand. The immovable object meets the irresistible force. What do you get? Nothing. That's what we have right now in Washington.
We'll talk more about your proposals for tax restructuring. A lot of other issues to get to, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-399-3566, the number to call. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a message on our Facebook page. Our guest today, Kevin Ray, Republican for U.S. Congress. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, J.R. Moringer talks about his new novel, Sutton, based on bank robber Willie Sutton, who was a folk hero in an era when the public hated banks.
As good as he was at robbing banks, he was even better at escaping from prison.
Moringer also wrote the best-selling memoir, The Tender Bar. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Stuck in America, upward mobility, the American dream, is at an all-time low. We'll look at what's happened to the ladder. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point this evening at midnight. Broadcast of Your Vote 2012 Maine Calling is made possible by MPBN listeners and by Lambert Coffin, celebrating 25 years of delivering strategic legal counsel on issues and opportunities in Maine with offices in Portland and Blue Hill, by Garand Marketing and Communications, serving clients here and abroad from offices in Portland, Maine, the happiest people in business, Garand.com, and by AARP Maine, working to protect Social Security and Medicare. More information online at aarp.org/ME.
And welcome back to Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Our guest today, Kevin Ray, running for Congress in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. He would like to unseat Mike Michoud, the incumbent Democrat, in that position. We'd like you to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Email talk@mpbn.net. Tweet at Maine Calling, or message us on Facebook. Speaking of Facebook, we have a listener who writes, named Robert, who writes, if tax cuts for millionaires create jobs, where are the jobs? They have had tax breaks for 8 years. If cutting government jobs is good for the economy, how does increasing job loss do that? Let's start with the tax cuts for the wealthy. Is that a way to stimulate the economy and create jobs?
Well, as your listener points out, what we're really talking about is not cutting taxes for the wealthy. We're talking about whether or not we're going to increase those taxes. Because with the expiration of the Bush-era tax cuts, we're poised to see significant increase for taxes, for taxpayers at all levels. And I think that would frankly be disastrous for the country. It seems like on issue after issue, we're driven to the brink of these sort of extreme outcomes by the lack of a willingness in Washington to sit down with each other and work through thorny issues. That's one of my major priorities in this race. And look, I recognize if I'm elected, I'm going to be a freshman member of Congress. I'm going to be one out of 435. And so, I don't have illusions that I can single-handedly change the tone and tenor of Washington. But I'll tell you what, I'd spent 17 years working at the side of Olympia Snowe, 6 years as her chief of staff in the United States Senate. And I have seen the difference that you can make when you're willing to talk with people. And that's what I did as president of the Maine Senate. We had a lot of difficult issues. If you remember when the 125th legislature came into office at the end of 2010, there were predictions that it was going to be an extremely rocky legislature. But we did something that I think really set a tone. At the beginning of that legislature, Barry Hobbins, the Senate Democratic leader, Emily Kane, the House Democratic leader, and Speaker Bob Nutting and I decided to come together for dinner every Thursday night that the legislature was in session. And we did that religiously for the entire 2 years of the session so that we built the kind of constructive relationships that would allow us to succeed. So we ended up passing tax cuts, historic tax cuts in Maine, on a bipartisan basis. I think that there's room for that kind of growth at the federal level as well in terms of working better together. The American people have a record low opinion of Washington, and rightfully so. What I'm saying in this race is that I bring to the table a proven record of doing just that. My opponent has been in Washington, D.C. for 10 years. During that time, while twice being named one of the 10 most obscure members of Congress, he has compiled a party line voting record of voting with his party. I believe it was 93% of the time. That's not the kind of record that is helping to change the dynamic. That's why I submit that I can be part of the solution, and that Mike, although he's a very nice guy and I know well-intended, has become part of the problem.
All right, let's go to the phones to Madison and John, who's been waiting patiently. Hi, John. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi. Hi.
Hi, John.
Thank you for having me on. Hi, Kevin. Kevin and I have met while walking a parade in Somerset County. And one of the things that I pointed out to him was all the boarded up businesses and buildings in Bingham and up that way. And Kevin, I'd like you to talk to us a little bit about what the differences are in your philosophy regarding the economy and what the government can do to jumpstart the economy, recognizing that you've already spoken a little bit about it, but take it a little further, please.
Yes. Good. Well, thank you, John. You know, you're absolutely right when you point to, you know, boarded up buildings. That's something that we see, frankly, far too many of all across the 2nd Congressional District. In my travels, I certainly see a pile of them. And again, it's because Maine has had, over the course of a number of years now, a reputation, apparently deservedly so, unfortunately, for having one of the highest rates of small business failure of any state in the country. I think in the top two or three, year after year after year. And that's why, as I mentioned at the outset, my emphasis on small business. I am a small business person. My wife and I have raised Mustard Mill up in Eastport, a quintessential family small business. We're not big by any chance, by any stretch. But we certainly are an important part of the economy in our community and in the lives of our employees. That's played out thousands of times across the state. So I do believe that it is appropriate to have an important emphasis on the ability of small business to succeed. If you take all of the small businesses in Maine together, they are far and away the largest employer we will have. There's the large companies don't touch it. And so I do believe that's important. I believe that getting our arms around our fiscal problems, you know, a $16 trillion national debt. Right now, we're increasing that on an annual basis by $1.3 trillion a year. Just this year, another $1.3 trillion. I believe that one of the ways that we can help to put the United States economy on a stronger foundation for job creation is to get our arms around that debt, to set priorities, and to make common sense choices as we have at the state level where we have to balance the budget. At the federal level, there's no similar requirement to balance the budget. And so absent a constitutional amendment to require that, I think we can predict more of the same. Congress will continue to avoid making the tough choices because it's hard work.
John, let me ask you, are those answers satisfying to you, cutting the deficit, the debt, and taking steps to promote small business?
They are somewhat satisfying to me. I'm not looking for the government to solve all my problems. I've been out of a job now for almost two years. Only found part-time work, and when I found out that I had no employment anymore, it was the first time in 50 years that I'd been not employed. I had to tighten my belt all around this place to keep the place afloat, and that's what I expect of state government, county government, local government, and federal government. So I want to send a man to Washington that's willing to make hard choices, figure out what the federal government should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing, and stop the rest of it. Put the brakes on, like I had to do in my house. That's what I'm looking for.
Exactly. I appreciate that, John. And that is what I was getting at in terms of, requiring the federal government to set those kinds of priorities, make choices, balance its budget in the same way that families have to, in the same way that state and local governments have to.
All right.
Good observation.
Sorry. Let's go to Surrey and Glenita. Did I pronounce that right?
Glenita.
Glenita, yes. Welcome to Maine Calling. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'd like to ask State Senator Ray if he can address the recent conflict and upheavals in the Middle East, realizing that in the president's budget there have been drastic military cuts. And in January 2013, the $500 billion additional military cuts will kick in if Congress fails to act. Could you comment on what this means from a national security point of view and what you would try to get changed so that the military cuts do not interfere with our national security?
Well, thank you, Glenita. And that's, I think, an extremely important issue that you raised. The prospect of this sequester hanging over the heads of our national security is frankly devastating, and it's symptomatic of what I was talking about a few minutes ago with respect to the paralysis that we see in Washington, where the two sides have not been able to come together to solve problems in a meaningful way, and so therefore this sequester, which was out there as you know, a stopgap, sort of the doomsday scenario, which was supposedly frightening enough that it would inspire Washington to come together to avoid it, is still very much out there and alive. And in the face of the upheaval we're seeing in the Middle East, with all of the uncertainty that that holds for U.S. national security and, frankly, worldwide, security is a good example of how, in many respects, Washington is fiddling while Rome is burning.
What about proposed cuts to the military? We hear about we need to reduce the deficit, we need to cut spending. Should we make cuts in spending in the military? If not, where?
Well, you know, I think you have to put everything on the table. When you're talking about making the kinds of cuts that are going to be necessary to begin to reverse this spiraling debt, obviously the Department of Defense is a significant component of the federal budget. But the thought that we are going to make the sort of willy-nilly chopping block approach cuts that would result from the sequester is, I think, perilous, and it would be a tremendous failure of leadership if it is allowed to proceed. I think we need to have, you know, as we do throughout government, a very close line-by-line-by-line look at the Defense Department budget to see where you can make cuts in a strategic, targeted way that will not thoroughly undermine national security, which is what is pending right now.
Let's talk a little bit about energy, if we could. The cost of energy as we enter the winter months, even of gasoline, is high. What can Congress do to change that, if anything?
Well, you know, that's another, I guess you're bringing up all the areas where there's been tremendous failure in Washington. I guess that's why there are issues under discussion, because there's little that Washington can point to in recent years that would suggest anything resembling a coherent national energy policy. We have, again, folks on one side who seem to be opposed to utilizing the natural resources of this country and prefer to look simply at conservation and some forms of alternative energy. And on the other side, you have people who sort of dismiss the importance of conservation and are talking only about drilling. Well, to be honest, I think that what these times call for, again, as with so many other issues, is for people to sit down, work through their differences, and do all of those things. We have tremendous resources as a country, and I believe that we are truly missing the boat in terms of some of the environmentalist pushing to diminish our ability to use our own God-given resources. I count among that, opposition to the Keystone Pipeline, opposition to expanding drilling in areas like, I know it has become a political football, but it is a modest proposal with respect to ANWR. If it can be done in a way that will protect the sanctity of a wildlife refuge by allowing a drilling in a small area, I think we need to look at that as a country and not be so polarized.
We've got to go to a break, but real quickly, do you support nuclear power?
I think nuclear power is an important part already of our national energy policy, and I think it will be going forward. I know there are obviously tremendous safety concerns around nuclear power, and I share those concerns, but it's part of our future. The Navy has certainly demonstrated the ability to use nuclear power successfully and safely over the years, and it needs to continue to be.
And real quickly, offshore drilling, yes or no, off the United States?
I haven't seen, I'm mostly familiar with offshore drilling with respect to the state of Maine. I haven't seen evidence that there are significant reserves that would justify offshore drilling off our coast. But I think with respect to drilling generally, in terms of across the country, that we're certainly not doing enough to utilize our resources.
Going to take a short break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments for Kevin Ray, Republican running in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. We'll be right back.
Next time on the TED Radio Hour, the power of crowds.
Media is increasingly more a site of coordination because groups that see or hear or watch or listen to something can now gather around and talk to each other as well.
What is the true potential of 21st century collaboration? Find out next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for that TED Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. If you have an iPhone or Android smartphone, there are a couple of easy ways to have MPBN travel with you wherever you go. First, there's the NPR News app, which allows you to locate MPBN Radio and then save it as a favorite. There you can also listen to the latest NPR news and the top stories of the day, as well as search for NPR reports by topic. Another simple way is to use the TuneIn Radio app, which allows you to search for your local stations. Once you find MPBN Radio, just save it as one of your favorites. These free smartphone apps, NPR News and TuneIn Radio, are available for downloading in your iPhone or your Android app store. Thanks for taking MPBN Radio along with you. Join us immediately following Maine Calling at 1 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. The speaker today is Todd Park, U.S. Chief Technology Officer and former Chief Technology Officer of Health and Human Services. That's the Commonwealth Club of California this afternoon at 1 o'clock, immediately following Maine Calling.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall, our guest today. Another Your Vote 2012 interview with the candidates on the fall ballot. Today, Kevin Ray, Republican, running in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. We were talking before the break, Kevin, about energy, and I wanted to ask you if you support tax subsidies or other incentives for alternative energy, wind, solar, tidal.
Well, I'm glad you raised that question, Keith. I've certainly been, from where I come from, the prospect of tidal power has long been a dream. The Passamaquoddy Tidal Power Project, dating back to the days of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, have been really a part of the heritage of the community where I was born and brought up. I do believe that emerging innovative alternative energy sources are deserving of governmental support. And so I have no problem with those alternative energy sources that are in their infancy having that kind of support. I do believe, frankly, it's a flaw if the business model suggests that ad infinitum, that any particular mode of energy is going to require as a long-term plan that level of support. To get things off the ground, absolutely. And we're seeing, I've been very supportive of ORPC and what they're doing to not only be able to harness the power of the tides, which is now happening with underwater turbines, but also providing significant employment in areas like Washington County.
Back to the phones in a moment. First, though, Greg on Facebook writes, do you believe that humans contribute to global warming?
Yeah, I do believe that there is incontrovertible evidence that we are in a period of global warming. I know that there is, you know, significant debate in some places in terms of how much of that impact is because of human activity. But you know what? The science tells us that it's happening, and I think as a people, as humanity, that we have an obligation to err on the side of being careful of what we are spewing into the environment. So, I think that we have an obligation to take it seriously, to do everything we can to ensure that we are not recklessly and needlessly adding to the problem, regardless how much of it is caused by humanity.
We have about 6 minutes left, so I'm going to try to get to calls quickly, and if you could please ask your questions quickly to Ellsworth and Larry. Hi, Larry. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I like your mustard.
Thanks, Larry.
I have a question. The constant argument between the parties, the facts are that Mr. Bush caused most of the debt, number one. And what good is it going to do were we to elect you? The Tea Party is now in control of the Republican Party, and the Tea Party refuses to talk to anyone. If you don't do what they want, that's the end of the conversation. And so, again, I don't understand how electing you is going to help us one way or the other. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin, do moderates have a place in Washington today?
Well, thank you for the question, Larry. And, yes, absolutely. You know, where things get done, both in Washington, Augusta, any capital, is when people come together to find common ground. And it's absolutely essential that we continue. Maine has had a long legacy of sending people to Washington who have made a difference, who have been willing to roll up their sleeves and do the hard work of trying to find consensus and dealing with people across the aisle. That was certainly the case with Margaret Chase Smith and Bill Cohen. I spent, as I said before, a number of years with Olympia Snow, watching her, working first with Senator Cohen, then Senator Collins, in that very constructive approach. If we don't do it, I'm very concerned about what it means for the future of this country. I would also add that while it may be a perception that, you know, it is because of Republicans or certain factions within the Republican Party that we have seen the kind of polarization in Washington, frankly, it takes two to polarize. And I can tell you that I know from my conversations with Senator Snow, that is how she sees it as well. You only need to look as far as Obamacare in terms of what President Obama has brought to the table in terms of adding to the polarization and partisanship in Washington.
So I assume you do not support Obama.
I do not support Obamacare. No, and I think particularly given the very unfortunate way in which it was handled. I mean, take Senator Snow for example. You had a seasoned veteran of Washington with a reputation, a sterling reputation for reaching across the center and building consensus, and she at some political peril was out front about her willingness to help work to negotiate a bipartisan plan to reform health care, because heavens knows health care coverage certainly did need reform. She was rejected. Olympia Snow was rejected because the president calculated that he did not need her, that he had enough votes with just Democrats. I don't know of an enduring social reform that has ever passed on such a partisan basis. And clearly, if social reform such as Obamacare is going to be enduring and have broad acceptance across the country, it is enormously helpful to engage both parties and
so
make it bipartisan.
You would vote to repeal it?
I would vote to repeal it. That's only part of it. I would vote to repeal it, but we also need to replace it. It's not enough to simply repeal it, because if you simply repeal it, it's to suggest that there's nothing wrong with health care in our country, and we have significant problems.
Real quickly, a couple things you replace it with.
We can replace it with a host of things that we could agree to on a bipartisan basis, some of which are components within the 2,600-page Obamacare law. But absolutely, we can agree that you should be able to buy health care across state lines.
Let's fit one more call in. Yes,
sir. And also that those with pre-existing conditions should not be denied. Nobody wants to see people denied health care.
Okay. Let's go to Owl's Head and Diane. Diane, quickly, please.
Yes. Well, while waiting, my question has changed. You sound like a very nice person, and but my problem is that as an ordinary citizen, I need you to tell me why I should trust any Republican with the welfare of all these important of our country and all of these important decisions after things that the Republican Party has done both in Maine and at the national level, but even here in Maine. For example, trying to keep people from voting and turning people against their fellow citizens who may need welfare benefits, for example. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Diane. I think that every voter has to make those kinds of determinations for themselves. But what I would ask Maine voters, and I think Maine voters have shown themselves very capable of doing over the years, is to judge the person. Look at the record of the person. In totality, what he or she has done with his or her life, the votes that they've cast in the past, and the role that they've played. But I think that you would find, if you talk with people who have served with me of both parties in the legislature, that I have been defined by my willingness to reach across the aisle, to try to solve problems, to do it in a thoughtful way. When there was a proposal, for example, in the biennial budget that would have had a very serious impact on elderly people living in assisted living, I said no. I was the first member of leadership who said, absolutely not. I will not support that. We have vulnerable populations in this state and in this country. They have been threatened by the fact that we have not set priorities. We need to prioritize the truly vulnerable.
Kevin Ray, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Keith.
Kevin Ray, Republican running for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Our show was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. Matt Schreiber screened your calls. We had help today from Steve Tilton. I'm Keith Shortall. Thanks for listening.